Friday evening of the camp meeting, I'd like to take up the theme from the book of Galatians, the third chapter. We could term this the adding of the law. The adding of the law. In the study of the journeyings of Israel from Egypt to Canaan's land, we noted that the events which followed the rise of Zimri and Balaam and their demise from the ranks of God's people, both of them were slain in the history of ancient Israel. They followed on the part of Moses just before his death on the borders of the promised land a repetition of the law. That repeating of the law was given in the book of Deuteronomy. Now it follows that likewise in the history of this people there must also come a restatement of the law of God. Now we've made the observation during the past week and in the very study of the principles which underlie God's kingdom, in the careful investigation of the very nature of the two powers of good and evil, that we have seen the very issue of law which was contested by Lucifer up there in the kingdom of heaven. And this was not an issue over superficialities, but an issue over the law itself in its most basic and deepest form. I'd like to pick up a statement here from the book Great Controversy on page 582. From the very beginning of the great controversy in heaven, it has been Satan's purpose to overthrow the law of God. It was to accomplish this that he entered upon his rebellion against the Creator. And though he was cast out of heaven, he has continued the same warfare upon the earth. To deceive men and thus lead them to transgress God's law is the object which he has steadfastly pursued. Whether this be accomplished by casting aside the law altogether or by rejecting one of its precepts, the result will ultimately be the same. He that offends in one point manifests contempt for the whole law. His influence and example are on the side of transgression. He becomes guilty of all. In seeking to cast contempt upon the divine statutes, Satan has perverted the doctrines of the Bible, and errors have thus become incorporated into the faith of thousands who profess to believe the Scriptures. The last great conflict between truth and error is but the final struggle of the long-standing controversy concerning the law of God. Upon this battle we are now entering, a battle between the laws of men and the precepts of Jehovah, between the religion of the Bible and the religion of fable and tradition. Now I believe that this statement which I have just read takes on something of a new meaning in the light of this last week's study. Let's go back over a moment to pick up some of the thoughts that we find in this statement. From the very beginning of the great controversy in heaven, it has been Satan's purpose to overthrow the law of God. From what time? The very beginning of the great controversy. Now, what was it that motivated Satan in this determination to overthrow God's law at the very beginning of the great controversy? It was because Satan found that that law stood between him and the fulfillment of his own personal selfish ambitions. Isn't that true? And because it did, he wished to have that law remodeled after his own design, so that in the remodeling of it, he would find a means whereby he could exalt himself to a position of preeminence above the heavenly host. I read on. It was to accomplish this that he entered upon his rebellion against the Creator. And though he was cast out of heaven, he has continued the same warfare upon the earth. Now we've seen in the little episode which has taken place this year, in miniature, a precise repetition of that same controversy which took place up there in the kingdom of heaven. Now I believe this, that we have to understand far better than we have just what the law of God really is. Now to help us to understand this, let's look at some situations which stand up very prominently and clearly in past history. I'd like you to go back with me to the experience of the Pharisees in respect to Jesus Christ. Come to Romans, the 10th chapter, and read with me verse 1 to 3, where Paul outlines the fatal mistake that the Jewish people made in their searching after the righteousness of Jesus Christ. Well, perhaps we should come back to the 9th chapter of Romans and verse 30 and read from verse 30 onward where it says, "What shall we say then? That the Gentiles, which followed not after righteousness, have attained to righteousness, even the righteousness which is of faith. But Israel, which followed after the law of righteousness, hath not attained to the law of righteousness. Wherefore? Because they sought it not by faith, but as it were by the works of the law. For they stumbled at that stumbling stone. As it is written, Behold, I lay in Zion a stumbling stone and rock of offense, and whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed. Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved. For I bear them record that they have a zeal of God, but not according to knowledge. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness, and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to every one that believeth. For Moses describeth the righteousness which is of the law, that the man which doeth these things shall live by them. But the righteousness which is of faith speaketh on this wise, Say not in thine heart, Who shall ascend into heaven? That is, to bring Christ down from above, or Who shall ascend into the deep? That is, to bring up Christ again from the dead. But what saith it? The word is nigh thee, even in thy mouth and in thine heart. That is the word of faith which we preach." And that, of course, is a citation from the book of Deuteronomy, the 30th chapter, I believe. Now, here we find that Paul states the great fact that the Pharisees and the Jews sought with all the willpower and zeal which they knew to achieve righteousness by the works of the law. Now, those men back there were men who made it their special business to study and to fulfill every particular that the law contained. And when they felt they had fulfilled every particular written in the law, what did they do then? They added more particulars to the law, so they could keep that in addition to what God himself had written. Isn't that true? They took the law and they obeyed every letter of it, and then in turn they went beyond that and added to the law of God other requirements that were not even written in the Word of God. Now, Paul himself described his previous experience as being one where he kept all the law of God, how? Blameless. Let's look up one or two of those scriptures. I think that the most interesting one of all is found in the book of Galatians, the first chapter and verse 14. Galatians 1 and verse 14. And there Paul describes his experience in the earlier days when he says, "And profited in the Jews' religion above many my equals in mine own nation, being more exceedingly zealous of the traditions of my fathers." And compare that with Philippians, the 3rd chapter, verse 5 and 6, where Paul has this to say in regard to his own previous life. "Circumcised the 8th day of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, and Hebrew of the Hebrews, as touching the law of Pharisee. Concerning zeal, persecuting the church, touching the righteousness which is in the law, blameless." Now then, let me ask you a question in respect to this. Here was Paul, who could say of himself, when it came to the righteousness which is in the law, he was blameless, and yet upon whose side of the question did he stand? Satan's side. Now, isn't that interesting? That's a fact, isn't it? There's no make-believe about that. At that very time when Paul could testify of himself that as far as touching the law was concerned, he obeyed every particular of it. And yet, at that very same time, he was actually doing his uttermost to destroy the church of God. He was, in actual fact, at that time, Satan's number one agent on the face of the earth. The man who was doing more than any other person living at that time to tear apart that which God was seeking to build up. Now, come back again to the experience of the Pharisees in relation to Jesus Christ. Now, before he came, they preached the law, until they were as dry as the hills of Gilboa without dew nor rain. They strove and they struggled. They studied and they worked. They read this particular of the law and that particular of the law until they felt that they were at least getting somewhere, and yet they still felt that they had more things to learn, more things to understand before they could finally achieve the fullness of righteousness. Remember the rich young ruler who came to Christ and said, Master, what good thing must I do to be saved? And what did Jesus say? What is in the law? Or go and keep the commandments. Just go and keep the commandments. And the young man said, I have kept the commandments from my youth up. What yet do I lack? And somehow you'll always find, if I may just digress you a moment, that those people who set their hearts to obey the law to its uttermost limit, if they have in them any trace of honesty yet, they always feel there's something yet they have to do. They'll always be searching for some new particular that they must keep, some new point to observe, or something like that. Now God, of course, sent into this situation where men were attempting to keep the whole law in that way, He sent into them a messenger of righteousness, and that messenger of righteousness was Jesus Christ Himself in person, the very one who was the actual lawmaker. Let's put that down here. The lawmaker. Now, if there was anybody who understood the law of God, it was Jesus Christ. He understood that law as nobody else could do, and what is more, He was the law and He lived the law. You read there in the book of Education, I was going to read it the other day and the book wasn't here, but it's been returned, so I'll just read the statement right now. It's such a beautiful statement. I love to read this again and again because it is to me a great inspiration. Page 78 to 79. What He taught, He lived. I have given you an example, He said to His disciples, that you should do as I have done. I have kept my Father's commandment. Thus, in His life, Christ's words had perfect illustration and support. And more than this, what He taught, He was. His words were the expression not only of His own life experience, but of His own character. Not only did He teach the truth, but He was the truth. It was this that gave His teaching power. It was this that gave His teaching power. And of course, you're familiar with the statement in the Old Testament, in the 42nd chapter of the book of Isaiah, in verse 21, there is a prophecy in respect to Christ when He would come to this earth, what He would do as He walked up and down in the ways of men, amongst men. Isaiah 42 and verse 21 says, the Lord is well pleased for His righteousness' sake. He will magnify the law and make it honorable. He will magnify the law and make it honorable. Now, if there's any question in your mind that this is a prophecy concerning Jesus Christ, then all you have to do is to read the 42nd chapter of Isaiah clear through and compare with Matthew chapter 12, verse 17 to 21. And there you find that Matthew distinctly applies this prophecy, of course, to the ministry of Jesus Christ. Now then, let's try now and think of this text as the Pharisee would interpret it. The Pharisee already had the idea of law-keeping as being one where you searched at every particular of the law and obeyed every particular of the law, and then when you obeyed all you could find, then you searched for still more so you could obey those in turn. So when they heard of a coming Messiah who would magnify the law, then what would they expect? More particularization, so they could have more things to obey, whereby they could in turn inherit the kingdom of heaven. And yet when Jesus came to magnify the law, although not as they expected, then what did those law keepers call the lawmaker? They called Him a lawbreaker. Isn't that right? They called Him a lawbreaker. They said, this man has no respect for the law of God. This man never preaches the law of God. That's what they said of him. This man is a lawbreaker. He is a blasphemer. He is one who is fit only to be destroyed. And they set their hearts to destroy him who was the lawmaker. Now, doesn't this then bring home to our mind something of a thought to think about Because we know that these men who were so zealous for the Ten Commandment law of God and the law of Moses and so forth, here they were so zealous for it, and yet whose agents were they? Satan's agents. Alright, so here then were Satan's agents in this controversy. But now I read here in the book Great Controversy that Satan hates the law of God. And it is his intention to overthrow that law as speedily as he can. Very good. Satan is crafty enough to know that to make a direct head-on attack against the law of God is to expose him to a position where nobody particularly is going to follow him. And so he replaces the real law of God, which is a great law of love and respect, so far as its basic principles is concerned, something which works from the inside out, he replaces that with a law which consists of a great series of particularizations and outward requirements that you must do this and you've got to do that and you've got to do the other thing, and calls that the law of God and makes his servants very zealous for that. And when the real preacher of the law of God comes along, the messenger of living righteousness, then these agents of Satan, who say we are God's folk because we keep his law so particularly, then go to war against the very Son of God, the lawmaker, and declare him to be one who has no respect for the law of God, who never preaches the law of God, and who is only a lawbreaker. Now this means then that we must be careful to understand in these last days just what the law of God really is. Because the last great controversy, conflict between truth and error, is but the final struggle of the long-standing controversy concerning the law of God. There it is. And that is why we can emphasize the fact that the better we understand the nature of the controversy as it began back there in heaven, the better we understand what that thing was actually over, just what Satan did try to overthrow back there in the kingdom of heaven, then the better we're going to understand the nature of the last great conflict, and the better we're going to be able to relate ourselves to that and be on the right side. It's no surprise to me that the experience of this last 12 months have come to us at this time in this world's history, because God knows that we need some educating. We need to have our minds turned back to a study of that first conflict. We need to be shown just what the controversy was over, just what Satan back there was trying to overthrow, and what he was trying to put in the place of what God had established. And haven't we seen in our study of the King of the North that the very thing which Satan tried to overthrow back there in the kingdom of heaven is the very thing which he's trying to overthrow in these last days? That is, the Satan's effort back there to make himself the one great being between God and the people is just what he will try and do again in these last days, when he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. And what reads the word of God? He shall come to his end and none shall help him. And in this conflict and controversy in our own midst in the last 12 months, have we not seen individuals who've tried to plant the tabernacles of their palace between the people of this movement and the God of heaven to usurp a position which God never, ever intended they should have because of their own unfitness for it and because of their own desire to have it not as a position of service but as a position of glory? The same thing exactly. Now come with me to Galatians, the third chapter. Read a text with which I mentioned at the beginning of this table, didn't come around to reading yet. Galatians, the third chapter, and verse 19. Galatians 3 and verse 19. Wherefore then serveth the law? It was added because of transgressions till the seed should come to whom the promise was made, and it was ordained by angels in the hand of a mediator. By the way, I meant to mention before I go any further than this that has not this picture of Christ and the Pharisees been repeated again and again through history? Let's come down to take another example, just one for the moment. Before 1888, what were the Advent people doing? They were preaching the law until they were as dry as the hills of Gilboa without June or rain. Isn't that true? And then when God sent to them two messengers of living righteousness in the person of Wagner and Jones, what did those great law keepers do to those men? Persecuted them, rejected their message, and told the people that they were overthrowing all the teachings of the Advent message. They were unsettling the foundations of the Advent faith. They were taking down the landmarks and the pillars of the message. And in every age and generation, when God gives to a man a living message of living righteousness, he can expect there'll be at least some people who are going to reject the message because he doesn't keep the law of God as they, because of their past training and experience, think he should keep the law. Isn't that true? There are many Pharisees and Jews back in those days who said, well, if Jesus Christ keeps the law as we keep it, and if we think he should keep it, we'll follow him. But they said he doesn't. He breaks the Sabbath day, he does this, that, and the other thing, and therefore we shall not follow him. Now, before I go any further, let's face this fact with care. No word which I speak tonight is to be interpreted as meaning that I have no respect for the law of God. Just as Paul said there in the 3rd chapter of Romans, what shall we say then? Do we make void the law through faith? And what's the answer? God forbid, yea, we establish the law. And what we're trying to do is what Paul spent the whole book of Galatians trying to do, and what Christ spent his whole ministry trying to do, is to sweep away the false concept of law and to replace it with the law of God, that great principle of living righteousness, which is the wellspring of love and joy and peace and gentleness and meekness and those things, which is the real law of God, the great principle of respect and love. Now, this being so, I want to ask you the question now. In the 19th verse of Galatians chapter 3, when Paul says, wherefore then serveth the law? And to answer his question, he says, if, the law he's referring to, it was added because of transgression. Which law was Paul speaking about? The moral or the ceremonial? Pardon? The moral law. Actually, Sister White says both, but more particularly the moral law. And that, of course, was a great surprise to Elder Butler back in the last decades of the 1800s. And he and E.J. Wagoner had quite a controversy over this. E.J. Wagoner took the position very firmly that the law referred to by Paul in the book of Galatians was the moral law, whereas Butler said, no, it's the ceremonial law, because Butler could not understand the relationship of grace and law or of faith and works. Now, to understand the fact that it was the moral law being spoken about, one has but to go back in this very 3rd chapter of the book of Galatians and pick up the context to Galatians 3 and verse 19. Come back to verse 1 and we'll just run down to the chapter fairly quickly and pick up some of the main points that Paul argues in this chapter. O foolish Galatians, who hath bewitched you that you should not obey the truth, before whose eyes Jesus Christ hath been evidently set forth, crucified among you? This only will I learn of you. Received you the Spirit by the works of the law, or by the hearing of faith? Are you so foolish? Having begun in the Spirit, are you now made perfect by the flesh? Have you suffered so many things in vain, if it be yet in vain? Now come back a moment to verse 1 where Paul says, who hath bewitched you? Now, what had happened to the Galatians? Paul had been down there amongst them and had preached the living message of living righteousness to a people who had been obeying the law in a Pharisaical way, in that old system of particularization of this little requirement, that little requirement. And they had been led out of that bondage into the freedom of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But after Paul, there had come in teachers who had criticized Paul and named him as a lawbreaker, and a disrespecter of God's requirements, and had told the people, unless they obeyed every little particular, that, as they interpreted it, of course, then they had no hope of eternal life, and the Galatians were bewitched and led back into this old system once again. So Paul asks the question there in the 2nd verse, receive ye the Spirit by the works of the law, or by the hearing of faith? Received you the Spirit? Now, when you have the Spirit, what do you have? The fruits of the Spirit. So Paul could have said there in that verse, did you receive love, joy, peace, gentleness, meekness, faith, and so on by the works of the law? And what's the obvious answer they must give? A truthful answer. Certainly not. Let's go back in our minds now a little ways and examine the past history of the Advent movement, and particularly of some of the reform groups. Take, shall we say, and I don't say any of this critically, but as an examination of the results which follow certain causes, when around about the turn of the 1950 decade, from 1950 up to 16, as we read last night in Hosea the fifth chapter and the 15th verse, and then chapter 6 verse 1, in chapter 5 verse 15 it says, "In their affliction they will seek me early." Now when back at the turn of that decade, many people began to realize that the Seventh-day Adventist Church was drifting very drastically away from the standards of the Advent message, then their reaction, the immediate reaction was to say, well now, we can't go with them. We must be careful to obey every one of these requirements. And I well recall the early books that came out by Nagel and some of these other folk, and these books spent their whole time reiterating the standards of the Advent message in all things. That is, in Sabbath keeping, dress reform, health reform, amusements, education, and so on. Which, of course, is good in itself. We don't say those standards are wrong. Not for a moment. Now, many folk in the world resolved that they were going to keep every one of those commandments to the very letter. But that resolution was made without the possession of the living message of righteousness which makes a man into a good tree. So therefore, while it was the best that we knew, the fact remains, and looking back now we can see that our effort back there was tantamount to trying to make a thorn bush produce apples. And it wasn't successful. Now you ask yourself the question, did any of you, or I should better say, did any of us, in consequence of that effort, receive the Spirit? Did we find that the result of that effort was to produce love, joy, peace, gentleness, meekness, and such like in the hearts and lives of those who went about the procedure in that way? Did it? It didn't, did it? Did it bring that for the Pharisees in their day? No. Did it bring it for the Advent folk before 1888? No. Did it do it for us? No. Did it do it for the Galatians? No. And that's why Paul said, did you receive the Spirit by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith? And they must answer, by the hearing of faith. Are you so foolish, having begun in the Spirit, are you now made perfect by the flesh? Have you suffered so many things in vain, if it be yet in vain? He therefore that ministereth to you the Spirit and worketh miracles among you, doeth he it by the works of the law, by the hearing of faith. Even as Abraham believed God and was counted unto him for righteousness. Know ye therefore that they which are of faith the same are the children of Abraham. And the Scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the heathen through faith, preached before the gospel unto Abraham, saying, in thee shall all nations be blessed. So then, they which be of faith are blessed with faithful Abraham. For as many as are of the works of the law are under the curse. For it is written, cursed is every one that continueth not in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them. But that no man is justified by the law in the sight of God, it is evident, for the just shall live by faith. And the law is not of faith, but the man that doeth them shall live in them. Christ hath redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us, for it is written, cursed is every one that hangeth on a tree. Now look at that verse 13, and what law could possibly be referred to there other than the moral law? Because what did Jesus come to redeem us from? Sin, didn't he? And what is sin? The transgression of the ceremonial law or the moral law? The moral law. And so it says, as plainly as it can be said, that Christ hath redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us, for it is written, cursed is everyone that hangeth on a tree. Now what is the curse of the law? It's disobedience, isn't it? The curse of the law is law breaking. It is having the evil principle of hatred, malice, bitterness, pride, and such like within our hearts, from which there flows forth that current of evil deeds, which is the outworking of the inward principle of unrighteousness. And so we read on. He did this in verse 13, so that in verse 14, the blessing of Abraham might come on the Gentiles through Jesus Christ, that we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith. Brethren, I speak after the manner of men, though it be but a man's covenant, yet if it be confirmed, no man disannulleth or addeth thereto. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made, he saith not, and the seed is of many, but as of one, and to thy seed which is Christ. And this I say, that the covenant that was confirmed before of God in Christ, the law which was 430 years after, cannot disannul, that it should make the promise of none effect. For if the inheritance be of the law, it is no more a promise, but God gave it to Abraham by promise. Wherefore then serveth the law? It was added because of transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made, and it was ordained by angels in the hand of a mediator. Now what does Paul mean when he says the law was added? Is not the law of God an eternal thing? Is not the moral law, that great Ten Commandment law, something which has been there as long as God has been there? Because the law of God is the character of God. It is but the expression of himself. What God is, the law is. So what then does Paul mean when he says it was added, something brought in later? To find the answer, we go back to the book Patriarchs and Prophets, wherein we find the statement made by the pen of inspiration, which tells us very plainly just what that scripture means. Patriarchs and Prophets, page 364. This is the chapter where Sister White is describing the law and the covenants. Here's a statement which I think exactly states the same truth as found there in the third chapter of Galatians in verse 19, and explains what was added back there at Mount Sinai. Page 364 in Patriarchs and Prophets. If man had kept the law of God as given to Adam after his fall, preserved by Noah and observed by Abraham, there would have been no necessity for the ordinance of circumcision. Now here's something I never noticed before, so I read the sentence right now. If man had kept the law of God as given to Adam when? After his fall. Now wouldn't you expect Sister White to have said as given to Adam before he ever fell? Wouldn't you? But she doesn't. She says if man had kept the law of God as given to Adam after his fall, preserved by Noah and observed by Abraham, there would have been no necessity for the ordinance of circumcision. And if the descendants of Abraham had kept the covenant of which circumcision was a sign, they would never have been seduced into idolatry, nor would it have been necessary for them to suffer a life of bondage in Egypt. Now comes the important part I want you to notice. They would have kept God's law in mind, and there would have been no necessity for it to be proclaimed from Sinai or engraved upon the tables of stone. And had the people practiced the principles of the Ten Commandments, there would have been no need of the additional directions given to Moses. Now isn't that something? There Sister White tells you what was added at Mount Sinai. The Ten Commandments in written form. I think that if we think this thing through, we will realize that the Ten Commandments can hardly be truly called the law of God. That may sound a very radical statement to make, but it is not radical when you consider the fact that the law of God is the character of God, and then ask yourself the question, how could the character of God ever be expressed in the limited language of the human race? How could it be? Therefore, the Ten Commandments is but a faint shadow of what the law really is. It's just as faint as human language is an inadequate expression of the great and brilliant and beautiful thing which is the law of God. And I would venture to say that it was with great reluctance that God ever did condense or bring that law down to the narrow confines of the framework of human language. I believe God did it reluctantly. The same as, I suppose, we would rather reluctantly bring down a magnificent piece of English literature and strip it down into the language of a little tiny child. How much would be lost from the original piece of literature? How little of the great expressions found in that original work would finally come out in that condensation into child language? How little? And so likewise, how little of the law really appears in those Ten Commandments. Let's go back a moment now and study into this thing very, very carefully. The law of God, that is, the law of God, is just as eternal as God himself. It is a reflection of God's own character, God's own thought, and God's own life. What God is, the law is. And what the law is, God is. Now, back there in the kingdom of heaven, that law was not presented in any written form, because it was written in the hearts and minds and the lives of every one of God's created beings, written there by the creative finger of God, and understood by the spiritual perception to a depth and a length and a breadth and a height impossible to the intellectual mind, especially when an intellectual mind is darkened by the perversion and a heart of sin. Now you cast your mind back a moment to the days before this message came. I remember only too well how that again and again I would read the book of Romans through and puzzle over that book. I wouldn't even attempt Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians and Colossians, and Corinthians I never opened, because I found that the book of Romans was a very, very hard book to understand. Just what was Paul trying to say? Back in those days, before this message came, there was over my eyes the scales of Laodicean blindness. But when the message came and I opened the book of Romans again, why, it was just a new book altogether. Just a new book altogether. Up there in Canada, one of our folk up there, every time I see him with a smile of great joy in his face, tells me how the Bible and the Spirit of Prophecy is just a different book to what it used to be altogether. Now, he said, they're living streams of living water. Before, they were just cold print arguments, facts, histories, doctrines, and prophecy. Sometimes, apparently, very contradictory. Many times, completely not understandable. Now, he said, they are to me living streams of living water. And we must face the fact that the inner spiritual man, when that man walks in the light of God's presence, has a power of vision far beyond that which is possible to the merely intellectual mind. Isn't that true? Far beyond. So therefore, up in the kingdom of heaven, when that law was written in the hearts of the angels, then the heart of God and the heart of his beings, that is, I just use the word angels here, the hearts of the angels, were one heart. And there was a continual response and a communication between the hearts of the angels and the hearts of God. And they kept the law as naturally as the fig tree bears figs or the rose bush yields roses. There was no effort, no difficulty, no problem, no straining after this requirement and that requirement, no worrying and fretting as to whether we were coming short in some little particular. All that was absent from heaven, completely unknown there. But there came, and likewise to Adam in the Garden of Eden. But when Adam fell from his higher state, then it was that the law, we just put here the word the heart of Adam, then the law of God was obliterated from Adam's heart, and no longer could there be that communication between God and man. God found that his messages to man found no response, and where there had been a bond of unity, now there was a carnal heart and there was enmity against God. Now man had a heart which was not subject to the law of God, neither indeed could be. How now could God possibly reach man? How could he? Through the one and only channel of communication which was left. And the one and only channel of communication which was left was the intellectual mind. That was all God had left. So therefore it became needful to spell out the law of God in a way that could be seen and understood by the intellectual mind. And obviously, of course, inasmuch as the intellectual mind has a much more limited grasp, a much more limited grip and understanding of the great truth of God, then the form in which it must be presented to the intellectual mind within the framework of human language must be a very inadequate presentation of that great law of God. Very inadequate. And that's why Sister White says, the law of God as given to Adam after his fall was a different presentation of the law of God as given to Adam before the fall. The law of God as given to Adam before the fall was something written upon the very heart and interwoven into the very nature of Adam. But Adam had lost that law completely. And now God had to come to him now and give to him something which his mind could grasp. And as he grasped that, then his mind could measure his own doings and his own being against the picture the law presented to him. And he saw that the picture the law presented to him and the picture of himself were two different pictures altogether. And that picture, that contrast then, would drove him back in penitence to God so that God could write that law again upon the heart of Adam and place him back into something of the same status he had before the fall. But of course, now the mind of Adam was weakened by sin, his nature was weakened, and he still couldn't see and understand all that the law of God had for him. Now as time went by, we come down through several thousand years of sin, we come down to a man which is degenerating all the time, and whose nature is becoming more and more hardened in sin. And as his nature becomes more deeply hardened in sin, then what happens to the mind of man? It becomes shrunken. It becomes darkened more and more and more until things come to that place where he can't even understand that which God gave to Adam even after his fall. And it was because of this that there was imposed upon God the necessity of coming down upon Mount Sinai and spelling out the Ten Commandments in that written form for the first time in human history. For the first time. But mark this point with care. Just because the law in that form was added because of transgression, it doesn't mean that the law of God has beginning at that point, as the Protestant churches try and teach. It doesn't mean the law is transitory and lasted but till the cross of Calvary. Not at all. But it does mean that the law in that form was added because the transgressions of men had made them incapable of seeing the law in any higher, fuller, richer presentation but that one couched in the feeble, inadequate language of human words and speech. But now the sad thing was this, that even then men could not understand the principles contained in that great Ten Commandment law. You know, I've had people come to me and say, how could that Ten Commandment law possibly be in heaven before the fall? Because we're taught that up in heaven there's no marrying nor giving in marriage. So if there's no marrying nor giving in marriage in heaven, then how could we ever expect to find the commandment in heaven, thou shalt not commit adultery? You know, when I hear that, when I first heard people say that to me, I was astonished that such a sentiment could ever be expressed. The application of the principles of the law to this human situation may be a little different application to the situation up in heaven. Because where circumstances change, the application of the law will also change, but the principle that underlies the application never changes. Never. And so when then upon this earth there's a situation where adultery is possible, then the principle of the law, which would forbid some other expression of that same wrong in heaven, that same principle now is applied to this particular situation in that particular way. And it doesn't have to be marrying nor giving of marriage in heaven for that particular principle expressed in that way, in that situation, to find its place also in the kingdom of heaven. No need for it at all. No difficulty there if we understand what the law is really all about. But when men were not able to understand and appreciate the law even in that form, then what did God have to do? We read it here. And had the people, note the words very carefully, practiced what? The principles of the Ten Commandments, there would have been no need of the additional directions given to Moses. In other words, when those folk could not even understand the law in that form, then God had to add to the law statutes, requirements, judgments, and particularizations in order to have those people see what the law of God itself was all about. Now let's go back to the kingdom of heaven itself, and here we have the great law of love and respect, which Satan broke and violated up there in the kingdom of heaven. And then down upon this earth there was the law as given to Adam, of which we have no written record to this time. And then we come down and there was added the Ten Commandments. I just put the Ten Laws here for brevity's sake. And then beyond that there came the statutes and the ordinances and the judgments and so forth that were given by God to explain that law that had been originally placed in the hearts of the angels. Now here is the point. There is absolutely nothing in those statutes, commandments and laws not already contained in the Ten Commandments if we could only see it. And if we had the true spiritual eye of faith, we would never need to read those because we see it all there in the Ten Commandment law. Now, there's nothing in the Ten Commandments not contained in that law given to Adam of which we have no written record. And if God came and spoke to us, He did to Adam after the fall and told us what He told to Adam, and if we had the true eye of faith and spiritual walk with God, then we would not need the Ten Commandments because we'd understand all God gave to Adam in that particular thing then. And if in turn we were back in heaven again, then because there's nothing in the law given to Moses, not already implicit in a far more wonderful way in that great law of love up in heaven, we would not need the law of Adam for us to understand the great law of God. These things were added because of what? Transgression. And what does transgression do to the mind of man? It blinds it. It reduces its capacity to understand and see what the truth of God really is. But now, there's still one more step in this adding of the law. There comes a time when the people of God violate a particular principle of the law by doing a particular thing on a particular occasion. And then it is that God speaks directly, that is a direct condemnation, I'll just put here the word condemnation, of a particular action which somebody has done. Now then, I'll give to you a very obvious example in this respect. No doubt you've all read in testimonies of the bicycle craze which hit America when the bicycle became a new invention. And instantly, it became a status symbol for a person to own a bicycle. And streets which had been the sole way of the horse and the trap and the sulky and the buggy suddenly had to give way to wearing wheels as people rode up and down on shiny new machines. Now Sister White came out and soundly condemned the practice of buying bicycles and riding them up and down the streets. But in actual fact she was not condemning the riding of bicycles. What she was condemning was the riding of bicycles as a medium for the expression of pride. Isn't that the point? She was condemning the riding of bicycles as an expression of pride. Some people, you meet the odd person who will go this far, and I quote this particular one because it's so obvious, and we can quote the same thing in many other respects. Some people will search through the Word of God, the Bible and the Spirit of Prophecy, and every time they come to a commandment like that, such as one condemning the riding of bicycles, they say, all right, we don't ride bicycles. But the same person will ride a horse, ride in a car, ride in a train, on a ship, or an aeroplane. Now, when it comes to the principle of the thing, what difference is there between riding a bicycle and riding a horse? Or in a train, or a car, or a plane, or a ship? What's the difference in principle? None whatsoever. Now, today, we ride in cars, automobiles, as you call them here, and when to pursue the work that I have to do, be it in as a farmer, as a salesman, as a tradesman, as a worker in the woods, as a minister, whatever else the case may be, I need a good serviceable car that'll fit my needs, then there's no sin, there's no violation of God's law in the purchase of that vehicle and the using of it. In the pursuit of my daily toil in the service of God and my fellow men. But if in the purchasing of my car I buy a new one every year, the very latest model, in order to gratify pride and to keep up with the neighbours, then the buying of that car becomes sin. Isn't that right? Then the principle of the law has been broken. Now the great problem with those whom we generally call legalists is this. that they will go through all these particular commandments they find in the Word of God, and they can never see beyond the bald, plain statement for what it says. They don't study to find out what particular principle in that particular circumstance was being violated, and then ask themselves the question, now in my situation today, am I or am I not violating that principle? Now give us one set of circumstances, and you can do a certain thing which is law-breaking in those circumstances, but give you another set of circumstances, and you can do the same thing exactly and not break the law of God at all. Isn't that true? The circumstances change, therefore the application changes, but the principle itself never changes. Let's take another example along that line to illustrate my point there. Supposing that Friday afternoon came and we were neglectful of proper Sabbath preparation, and we failed to gather out of our garden the salad vegetables we needed for Sabbath lunch. Would you not be a Sabbath breaker if next morning you went out and gathered that produce from the garden? Well, obviously you would. But supposing that another Sabbath came by and you had most carefully prepared for the Sabbath for every emergency which you knew. And then on Sabbath morning you got an urgent telephone call from a neighbour who had a very, very sick child, shall we say, and that neighbour wanted some lemons urgently for the sick child. Now you hadn't anticipated this, you had no idea this was going to happen, but you had a lemon tree full of lemons out in the garden, but you hadn't picked any. Because you had other plans for Sabbath lunch, maybe it was not salad day, it was something else you were going to have, and the lemons had not been gathered in. Now you do the same thing exactly as you did before. The action is the same. You go out and you gather produce from your garden. But this time, would it be a violation of God's law? It wouldn't. In both cases, the action is the same. The principle of the law is the same, but the circumstances have changed, and therefore, the application of the law has changed. That's why we must be very careful not to judge one another in what we do, because we don't always understand the circumstances involved and the motives involved and just what is going on. But imagine, if a legalist was going past your garden on that Sabbath morning with his Bible under his arm, going down to the church and saw you out there gathering lemons upon the Sabbath day, a man very zealous for the law of God, how he would hurry down to the church and spread the story around of what an awful Sabbath breaker you were. Remember how the Pharisees saw the disciples of Jesus Christ plucking grain upon the Sabbath day and rubbing it, blowing away the chaff and eating the grain on their way home from the Sabbath morning services, and how the Pharisees pounced upon this and tried to charge them before Christ as being lawbreakers. And what did Jesus do? They say, yes, I'm very sorry, these men of mine, they have to learn, I'll rebuke them for it and I'll bring them to heel. Did Christ say that? Did he condemn them? Were they Sabbath breakers in his eyes? They weren't, were they? Now, this is a subject, that is, the matter of the law versus grace, which has been the point of controversy right down to the history of mankind. Now, I believe the time has come when the great law of God has to be repeated to us as a people, and we have to come to learn the great principles of the law, and learn that not the rigid following out of the particularizations of the law is the keeping of the law, but to find in every application of the law to different circumstances through history an educating of us of what is the underlying principle behind this particular application. And then to discover that, and when we have discovered that, to let that thing work out in the hearts and lives of each one of us right down the line. Now I love that great promise that's given to us in the 8th chapter of the book of Hebrews. It's a promise that is written for God's folk in these very last days, because we are a people who have to fight the last great battle between righteousness and sin. And this is not going to be a battle about particularization of the law. This is going to be a battle in the last days between those people who will not support the papacy in his efforts to put himself at the head of the world, but will say that we stand behind the principles of Jesus Christ, the principle of self-sacrificing service. Hebrews the 8th chapter, let's begin with verse 10. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. And they shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for all shall know me, from the least to the greatest. For I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. In that he saith, A new covenant he hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. Now there is the promise, that just as back in the kingdom of heaven the law of God was written in, right in the very hearts of the angels, so God promises again to write that law right in the very hearts of his children. And when that law is written there, we shall have a concept of the law of God such as is impossible to those who do not have the enlightenment of God's Spirit. The old bondage of legalism, that straining after the particularizations of the law, will be a thing of the past, and will come instead the glorious freedom of the children of God. And having gained that freedom, as Paul says in the Galatians, the 5th chapter in verse 1, then he says to all of God's children, Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. The law of God was never planned on his part to be a bondage, a burden, a pain to carry around, but rather it is something which brings to us the joy and the happiness of real living and makes us to be real men and real women. And so as we approach this last great conflict, may it be that we shall go back and dig deep into the first great controversy in heaven and understand just what law was the point of controversy there, just what there Satan is trying to overthrow, and see how he's put up all down to the ages a false law, that is, a law of particularization, the Pharisaical law, even the Adventist law, as we might say it, back there before 1888 and even after, the Reformed Church's law, which never does bring joy, peace, happiness, or bind families together. Let's go back and find the real law of God and live it out, knowing that in the last great conflict, only those of us who do know the law of God will ever stand upon his side. In this last 12 months, we have been through the last great conflict in miniature. And only those of us who take an absolute stand upon the right side today can ever hope to take a stand upon the right side then. So may we see in this year's experience something of a rehearsal, such as folk on the stage go through to perfect their final performance. Let's see this last year's experience as a rehearsal given us of God before the curtain goes up on the last great conflict, a rehearsal designed to prepare us to make that final performance a perfect one and a victorious one. May God bless us tonight and help us each one, is my prayer for Jesus' sake.